This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Enjoy. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. All this week, journalists with the New England News Collaborative are telling stories about how the homes we live in can help us counter climate change. This week-long series is our way to mark Earth Day. Later in the show, we're going to have our own conversation here on Vermont Edition about climate change and housing. We're going to learn how to get your home off of fossil fuels. An environmental journalist and energy consultant will share advice on electric appliances, solar panels, and heating and cooling systems. But first, let's check in on what's going on in Montpelier. The end of this legislative session and the biennium is just a few weeks away. Lawmakers have yet to finalize some of the year's most significant legislative packages, like ones that would update Vermont's land use law or the education funding system. Joining us now to discuss is Senator Phil Baruth. He's the Senate President pro tem, representing Burlington, Winooski, Colchester, and Essex. Senator Baruth, welcome.
Thanks, Michaela. Good to be here.
Yeah, I hear you just ran over to our studio in Montpelier. Thank you for doing that. Sounds sure. Like a busy time. Now, Senator, the last time we spoke on Vermont Edition, it was the very first day of the legislative session back in January. What would you say are you and your fellow lawmakers' biggest wins from the past 4.5 months?
Well, you know, win is one of those words that you don't like to use because it sounds like you're spiking the ball. But what I would say is that I'm extremely proud of the work we've done on flood safety, disaster preparedness, climate mitigation. It's a gorgeous day outside right now. And I think when the sun is out, people forget that we have a new relationship to the rivers that make up much of Vermont. And that relationship is fraught, because those rivers now contain so much more energy and water than they used to when we have a rain event. So we came into this session determined to make changes in the short, medium, and long term around how we deal with river corridors. So I'm very proud to say that we passed S-213, which is our major river safety bill. And it includes three basic parts. We're taking care of dams. If people will remember during the flooding, there was great concern about dams being overtopped, dams crumbling, and endangering people on down the way. And so dam safety is a big part of that. There's funding for increased safety, river corridor protections and mapping. Among other things, we need to be thinking smarter about where we develop. We don't want to be putting things in the expanded floodplains. And then our wetlands, I think some people over the years, over the centuries really, have thought of wetlands as places that we need to fill and get rid of. We have learned the hard way that we need those lands to absorb the extra water that's coming at us as a result of climate change. So in 213, there are measures to make us a net gain state in terms of year-to-year percentage of wetland. So hopefully between stronger dams, river corridor mapping and monitoring, and wetland protections, we get more safety in the medium and the long term. And then in the short term, we tried to make people as whole as we could from their losses last summer.
Well, can you tell us a bit more about that? Let's focus just a bit on the short term, because God forbid, we're coming upon summertime again, there's always a chance of another flood. How is the legislature helping people recover from the last one?
Sure. So the first thing that went out really were what was called BGAP, business grants to make businesses whole to the extent we could, trying to make sure that downtowns like Montpelier's don't wind up hollowed out because businesses can't make it through. We found out again the hard way that FEMA offers low interest loans in most cases and not grants. And so the state stepped in there, and I would credit the administration as well as a fast moving e-board, which is what has the ability to move money when we're out of session. So we got money out to businesses. We got money out at the beginning of this session to municipalities, very flexible funding that allowed them either to use it as match for FEMA dollars or for other purposes. I will say, in terms of long-term thinking, if you take the State House campus, for instance, I went on a tour of the affected buildings, and they were badly affected, badly flooded. And so we lost a lot of equipment. We lost electricity generating ability. We lost heating equipment, et cetera. So those things are being moved to higher ground. And in a similar way, for instance, Montpelier put forward a request to have a number of homes elevated at the riverside or near the riverside so that people in the future could escape flooding on that first level. And so there is money in the budget that we just passed out to elevate some of those homes. And that's in general what we're trying to do, is bring to consciousness the idea that the weather is no longer our friend. We're going to have flooding. It's not going to be once in a century. It's going to be once, if we're lucky, every 10 years, but maybe every other year. And so, like many countries around the world, we're going to have to be thinking about how to get things to higher ground. And that includes our State House complex, too.
Hmm. Well, Senator Bruth, one of the biggest topics of conversation and debate in Montpelier this session has been school funding. Just a week ago today, six more school districts voted down their school budgets for a second time. And schools are now asking lawmakers to help come up with a plan in case they don't have an approved budget by the start of the next school year. What comes next? How do we get out of this?
So a couple of things that I would want people to know. First of all, in Vermont, we have always had a three-party consensus around the idea of local control, and especially when it comes to things like school budgeting, school curriculum. The idea has always been that we wanted communities to be making those decisions. So no central budgeting from Montpelier. Now, by and large, that stood us in good stead. We usually had increases anywhere from 3 to maybe 6-7%, something like that. In this particular case, last year, a number of things came into play in one year. So non-property tax revenue was down, but the value of real estate shot way up. And those two things had a combined effect. We were still weaning ourselves off of federal money that we had used in some cases to hire people in at schools to mitigate some of the problems from the pandemic. And then a number of districts carried those people into their regular budget. But the big driver was healthcare costs. We have statewide healthcare bargaining, and that came in at around 16%. So when you put all of those things together, it put us in a hole $200 million plus. And that means that we would have a tax rate maybe 15%. So more than double what we would normally have. The legislature in general, I believe, is working 24 hours a day. Speaking for myself and my office, we're definitely every single day engaged in discussions about how to bring that number down. But beyond that, how do we make sure it doesn't happen next year and the years following? So the House Committee on Ways and Means has released a good basic bill on what we call the yield. And that's the place where we determine tax rates for the education funding system and other necessary measures. So what the House did, I think, was to, for the most part, reinstate excess spending penalties that we had suspended a few years back. Those are back in force, and the Ways and Means Committee eliminated a lot of the exemptions to those. So they're back in force with more teeth. And I think that will help. But I'm also exploring, are there ways that we can, maybe for the next year or the year following, actually limit the growth of spending from Montpelier to make sure, doubly sure, that we don't have such a rise in property taxes 2 years in a row.
Hmm. Well, I did want to ask you more about the House yield bill, as it's known, because Governor Scott issued a statement about it that in part reads, quoting here, "Vermonters already face a daunting tax burden. Too many are struggling to get by and simply cannot afford to see their costs continue to go up." And the governor added that he can't accept this version of the bill and he hopes the Senate doesn't either. What's your response?
Well, let me say this. Phil Scott came forward with his own plan from his tax commissioner, Craig Beaulieu, and that plan was immediately shot down by the state treasurer, who pointed out that it would most probably tank our bond rating. And that's something that nobody wants. That would be a financial disaster. But it shows the, you know, the trouble with trying to rush a plan out. And so, to their credit, the House Ways and Means Committee has been working diligently all through the session. What they've got here, I think, adheres to the principle of do no harm. Question in my mind is, does it go far enough? So I'm in discussions with Joint Fiscal about that and with my money chairs, and we'll see if we can strengthen the bill. But I'm confident that they haven't done anything that will worsen things. And in education finance, that's always a threat.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll be keeping an eye on that. Thank you for that update. Let's turn to Act 250, Vermont's land use law. The legislature has been working on a few different bills to revamp Act 250 with the goal of spurring more housing development while still protecting wild spaces. And the one that seems to have received the most traction is two merged bills from the House and Senate. First, briefly, what exactly does this bill do? This package.
Okay, this is going to be hopelessly inside baseball for most people, and so I won't go into the gory details of which bills have been attached to which bills and how they're going to move. I will say that there is a very, very solid plan in place, agreed to by House and Senate leadership, to move this bill forward. It includes a modernization of Act 250, and it includes lots of stimulus for increased housing and removing regulation where it's deemed to be prohibiting extra development. So I think there's a broad building-wide consensus that we are in a housing crisis. Act 250 needs to give in some areas, places where we have duplicative regulation. So, for instance, in a municipality like Burlington or Winooski, where you have very robust zoning and infrastructure, do you need Act 250 there to regulate it? I think the consensus by the stakeholders and the chairs of the committees of jurisdiction on both sides has been that, no, you probably don't need that duplicative regulation. So Act 250 would be eased in some areas of the state, and the caps that we've traditionally had on the number of units you could develop would be eased or eliminated. So the idea is to produce a surge of housing in the exact places where we want it and not where we don't want it. Part of that will involve statewide mapping for different areas where places where we don't want to disturb the natural beauty, but we still want to allow some targeted development. Act 250 will still stay in place. But in those communities where we already have robust infrastructure and zoning, Act 250 would, in a balancing act, be lifted.
Well, Governor Scott has already signaled a potential veto, arguing that this package doesn't go far enough in encouraging housing development. Do you have that potential veto in the back of your mind as this bill formulates, making sure that, once the final version goes through, that it'll also have enough support to possibly override a gubernatorial veto?
I will say that we've you know, honestly, we've started to hear the word veto so many times with so many bills that has lost some of its force. So the governor is far and away the record holder for the most vetoes in history. And his number of vetoes, if you exclude Howard Dean, I think, is maybe verging on more than all the governors preceding him. So that's his decision to use the veto that freely. But what it means is that people start disregarding or lessening their thinking about that threat. So we're always concerned to try to get a bill signed. That's the only way it's going to become law other than an override. And an override is very difficult to orchestrate. So we would like to work with the governor. And we believe what we've been doing is adhering to a stakeholder consensus that was worked out very laboriously in the off session. And we have historic buy-in from environmental groups, the Chamber of Commerce, the League of Cities and Towns. Lots of people are in favor of this balanced compromise that we're pushing forward. And by the way, I should say that the Senate plans to move the large bill out that includes the House legislation and our approach. That'll come out by the end of the week. The goal is to have a conference committee that will have two full weeks to work and reach ultimate compromise. At that point, here is my prediction, and I may be wrong. I predict the governor will sign it, and we will have a joint press conference where we all sing Kumbaya.
All right. If that happens, we'll air it in full.
You heard it here first.
All right. Well, Senator, a handful of long-time senators have announced they are retiring or stepping down, won't be seeking re-election next year. Senator Dick Mazza, Dick McCormack, and Bobby Starr. And last election cycle, 11 senators vacated their seats. What does this turnover mean for the future of the Senate?
It means a lot of things, and I want to just, on a point of personal privilege, as we say in the Senate, I want to say that Bobby Starr is someone who's been such a close friend, such a mentor to me, and I will miss him powerfully. Dick McCormack has been a hero of mine over the years for the way he's handled, among other things, union issues. And then Dick Mazza is someone I worked with on the committee on committees very closely, and to see his health issues has really been hard for all of us. So, you know, when you say goodbye to these people who have given their heart and soul for 20 years or more to the institution, it's very difficult. But one of the difficulties is that next year, we will have half the Senate, 15 senators or more, will have 2 years or less experience. And that is a sea change. It's to the good in many ways. You get new enthusiasm, new perspectives. But there's a danger there that you lose institutional memory and you lose people who are used to operating the system, you know, on a moment's notice. And so there's a lot more training that goes on and a lot more team building that we have been doing, but that we'll do a lot more of.
Hmm. Well, Senator Phil Baruth, I have to ask you one more question before we let you go. Now,
sure.
I read in VT Digger a couple months ago that you and your daughters are big Taylor Swift fans.
Absolutely.
What do you think of the new album?
You know, I think Taylor Swift operates in many modes, but the two basic ones I would say are one that my daughter calls bangers, you know, real upbeat tunes with lots of high harmonies and kind of a really crisp synthesized sound. And then the other are, you know, where you turn the light down and you listen and it's a kind of moody vibe. And I think this album is more in that latter mode. Not my favorite of the two, but I'm working my way through the release, and that's a joy in and of itself.
Ever a diplomat. Senator Phil Baruth, thank you so much for joining me.
My daughters are listening, I think so. Thank you, Michaela.